Stay with us now as 98.7 WFMT brings you Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, a new monthly series presenting interviews with authors before a live audience. It's a unique collaborative effort of Chicago Magazine, 98.7 WFMT, and Looking Glass Theater Company in the Water Tower Waterworks. Victoria Lautman's guest today is the brilliant young author Jonathan Safran Foer. Foer achieved meteoric success with his first novel, Everything is Illuminated, published in 2002 to great acclaim. His eagerly awaited and electrifying new novel is Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close.
Thank you. Thank you so much, and welcome to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. What an amazing crowd today. I want to remind people that this is a free monthly literary interview series that's been going on since September. The partners on this are Chicago Magazine, 98.7 WFMT Radio, hosted here at the fantastic Looking Glass Theater, which is going to be opening next month their production of Hillbilly Antigone. Sophocles meets Little Abner. You should get tickets. It sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. There'll be music, snake charmers, and we are very grateful to them that they allow us to broadcast live from here every month. I will be telling you what we've got coming up after the break in about a half an hour, but, you know, we're all here for Jonathan Safran Foer, my guest. And if you have been traveling at Ulaanbaatar or Vanuatu, perhaps you have not been following the feeding frenzy of press about his latest book, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. Did I get that right? I always keep...
Right.
You know what? Every now and then I'm thinking it's extremely illuminated, and I've sort of like conflated the two titles. In any case, this is the most anticipated book since the incredible debut in 2002 of Everything is Illuminated, which is going to be a movie premiering in August. But, you know, I got to tell you that really the book aspect of Jonathan Safran Foer is just the tip of the iceberg, and we're going to explore a little bit what's beneath that tip that we're all familiar with later on in this program. For the next 60 minutes, this man is all ours. So it's my pleasure to welcome Jonathan Safran Foer. And we're going to dive right in. The character of Oscar Schell, the 9-year-old protagonist of this book, who is one of the most memorable characters most of us have read recently. Unusual to be a child, unusual as a child, that is so precocious and brilliant and neurotic. I know that this was not a character that you set out to write. At some point, Oscar Schell took over as the narrator of this book. Why did you decide, and what point did you decide, to present this book through the eyes of this narrator, and in particular, this particular child?
I try when I write, or I don't even know if I try. What ends up happening is not that I choose for things, but that I don't choose against things. I mean, in a way, an even more explicit example in this book is that September 11th would play into it at all. I did a reading in Boston maybe a week ago, and a writer stood up and said, I had been working on this novel around 2002, and everything kept veering toward New York and veering toward September 11th. And she said, at a certain point, I made a very conscious decision not to write about it. I didn't want to. And that sounded right to me. I think that people who aren't writing about, you know, a certain... something like September 11th, let's say. I imagine every writer's writing veers toward it, and you make a conscious decision not to. To me, that's like the most horrible thing I could ever do as a writer, is ever choose against something, particularly if it's an instinct. So when I was writing Oscar, I had started with an totally, entirely different book. The protagonist was this old man in Europe. He was a diarist. He wrote this important diary. He ends up disappearing and reappearing in the present moment in New York in a museum dedicated to his life. Needless to say, for anybody who knows anything about this book, there's none of that is there. But I never put down that book to start this book. It just kept changing, I think, by a process of not deciding against my intuitions and my instincts. You know, writing is so... I find it so hard in so many different ways, but one way is just any material keeping your interest over 3 years. And it has to be much more than interest. It has to be something that you're just completely energized about and want to go, something that justifies all of the self-consciousness and vulnerability, all of that. And for whatever reason, when I started writing Oscar, I don't even remember where he came from. He probably came from an invention, and I wanted to attribute the invention to a character. Or I have a cousin who's maybe kind of vaguely like him, or yeah, something I saw. Who knows? I had no intention of writing a lot about him. But then I found that I felt so sympathetically toward him that he was really making me laugh. And, you know, not that much, I don't know about you, not that much makes me laugh. And I guess this audience is easier than me. But, but particularly day after day after day. And so when you find something that appeals to those instincts and just appeals to the most visceral level of laughter or tears, whatever, then you want to stick with it. And so I did, and he ended up just eating through the book.
Before we go further, actually, the first thing that we decided you were going to read is a great introduction to Oscar Schell, in case people have not actually met this character yet. Would you mind? Let's just dig in with that.
Sure.
This is really, this is like page two.
It's literally page two.
Yeah, but it's, I mean, it'd be easier if you just read him than for us to keep describing him.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So he's 9 years old. I don't remember if we said that. Lives in New York. Has a number of sort of funny ways of saying things like heavy boots. It's not really instead of anything. It is exactly what it sounds like. But for the purposes of making this simple, it's kind of like sadness, depression. He says Jose instead of No Way Jose. He's a Francophile. He loves the Beatles. Just your average 9-year-old. I desperately wish I had my tambourine with me now, because even after everything, I'm still wearing heavy boots, and sometimes it helps to play a good beat. My most impressive song that I can play on my tambourine is The Flight of the Bumblebee by Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, which is also the ringtone I downloaded for the cell phone I got after Dad died. It is pretty amazing that I can play The Flight of the Bumblebee, because you have to hit incredibly fast in parts, and that's extremely hard for me because I don't really have wrists yet. Ron is Oscar's mother's friend. Ron offered to buy me a 5-piece drum set. Money can't buy me love, obviously. But I asked if it would have Zildjian cymbals. He said, whatever you want. And then he took my yo-yo off my desk and started to walk the dog with it. I know he just wanted to be friendly, but it made me incredibly angry. Yo-yo moi, I told him, grabbing it back. And what I really wanted to tell him was, you're not my dad, and you never, ever will be. Isn't it so weird, if you think about it, how the number of dead people is increasing, even though the earth stays the same size, so that one day there isn't going to be room to bury anyone anymore? One fascinating thing is that I read in National Geographic that there are more people alive now than have died in all of human history put together. In other words, if everyone wanted to play Hamlet at once, they couldn't, because there aren't enough skulls. My experience has been, the longer I remain silent after I read that line, the better the line
is. Yeah, there
was
definitely a there.
In fact, the interview could end right now. So, what about skyscrapers for dead people that were built down? They could be underneath the skyscrapers for living people that are built up. You could bury people 100 floors down, and a whole dead world could be underneath the living one. And sometimes I think it would be weird if there were a skyscraper that moved up and down while its elevator stayed in place. So if you wanted to go to the 95th floor, you'd just press the 95 button and the 95th floor would come to you. Also, that could be extremely useful because if you're on the 95th floor and a plane hits below you, the building could take you to the ground and everyone could be safe, even if you left your birdseed shirt at home that day.
Jonathan Safran Foer, reading from Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. There's two things in that whole section that you read that people don't realize if they're listening to it. And the first is that he refers to his father dying. His father died September 11th when the planes crashed into the World Trade Center. That is an important fact. Some people have focused on it as the most important fact in the book, which personally I don't agree with. But the other thing is that a little bit later on, Oscar finds a key in his father's closet, which leads him on one of the other stories in the book, which is a search for the meaning of the key in the lock, that it fits, and it takes him to the five boroughs of New York. And you also meet an incredible array of characters. There are, 472 blacks in the Manhattan phone book that he looks at, 216 addresses. He only gets up to Peter Black is the last one. But this was an interesting technique, I thought. And I am not a writer, but I can recognize, now that's a great idea. Because every person he goes to meet it's like a little story unto itself. It's like a little condensed bouillon cube of experience. They're like pearls on a chain, and that was a great idea because you obviously had a really good time thinking of each of these characters as a separate story.
I think maybe unlike a lot of writers, I have no sense of what I'm going to write before I start writing it or even while I'm writing it.
God, that sounds so complicated.
It's simple if you think about it because you don't have to have a plan. You know, it's like the W.H. Auden once said, I look at what I write so that I can see what I think. And that's so much the case for the way I do it. I don't have a set of arguments to make. I don't have messages. I don't even have a plot in mind or characters. It's more that I open myself up. It's like wandering down a dark hallway and you sort of fumble. Where's the light switch? Where's the light switch? Then you find the light switch at the very end and you turn around and the whole hallway is papered with the book you just wrote. Even though it wasn't that kind of deliberate process. It wasn't it was at its, you know, as unselfconscious as it can be. And I think there's something about the way that I write that is more, it's like there are, two kinds of, I'm sure there are many kinds, but two major models of sculpting. There are people who do subtractive sculpture and additive. And subtractive, you take a block of marble, you think, I would sure love to get my, mother out of this, and then you carve it down until you've moved everything away except for the mother. And then...
Interesting choice.
I was going to say, probably very telling. And there are other people who have some clay, and they say, hey, maybe I'll make a sculpture out of this. And they start putting it together, and then there's like a spoon on the table, so you stick that on because it kind of looks like an ear, and there's like a pencil, so you dig out some nostrils with a pencil, and then you say, this looks like my uncle. Maybe I'll try to make it my uncle. I didn't have any idea who. Or maybe it's not even a person. Maybe it's like the dog that I had when I was a kid, and I'll make it my dog. And when I work, I leave myself very, very open to the idea that I could be entirely wrong about what I had thought, that I could change very, very dramatically. And the only expense is that you've wasted pages, which is no expense. Whereas, to my mind, the other way, what's the best that you can do? If you set out to do something, the best that you can do is do what you set out to do. You could fulfill your own expectations. I don't trust my expectations. I don't trust my abilities. Susan Sontag said that her books were better than she was. And I think every writer probably depends on that in different ways, in the idea that you can exceed your abilities by opening yourself up to chance and opening yourself up to accidents.
But then you, at some point, excavate something from whatever, the 2,500 pages I read that you wrote and the 331 drafts. And I understand the process, and you've talked about how you've also equated it with building a ship as you're crossing the ocean and using the parts of that ship to create more ship. And when you arrive at the other side, you've got a totally different ship. But at some point, you've excavated a specific book out of whatever the block of marble or the accreted clay and whatever you want to make an analogy out of. So decisions are made about it. You have to shape it at some point. At what point did you decide that this was the shape of this book? Or am I making it be too specific?
No. First of all, I should apologize because I was a philosophy major in college, and I actually didn't acquire any ideas in that process, but a certain very annoying way of talking, which always relies on
metaphor.
And it's and sometimes I hate hearing myself talk like that, but it's really the simplest way to say things sometimes. So here's another. It's like singing in the shower. That's how I think about writing. Is you like the way, do you ever sing in the shower?
Oh, God, no. Okay. I sing in the car.
Maybe
is that
I
the
should
same?
Use another analogy.
No. I can understand your analogy.
The car works fine.
Okay.
You like the way your voice sounds in a particular environment. Like it resonates in a certain way. It sounds better than it would in another environment. And so you go with it. It's very expressive and somehow maybe liberating. That's how I feel when I write. But there's a difference between singing in the shower and singing with the hope of having an audience or ideally having somebody sing along with whatever you're singing. And so, somebody who performs on a stage makes choices that somebody who sings in a shower doesn't. Getting dressed being the most obvious. But, what songs are you going to sing that could facilitate sharing? What key should you sing in? Like, you get a sense of what your vocal range is and what can you do? And the first part of the process of writing for me is very intuitive and very I don't worry about those things. But then at a certain point, I decide that one of the things I value most about writing is how it can be shared with other people, how it's not an individualistic act. When I was younger, I had all of these ideas about the compromises of publishing a book. Like, it drove me crazy that there had to be page numbers in a book. That just really irked me endlessly. I thought they have nothing to do with the book. They're these totally artificial tack-ons in the interest of, like, some teacher being able to say, can we flip to page 88 and talk about the third paragraph? And I wanted no description of the book. I wanted no barcode, God forbid. No author photo, which I still would prefer not to have. And now I feel differently. I feel very, very differently. Because one of the things I've come to appreciate about writing is how, like, its function in a culture, that it's not something that, it's not any kind of form of pure expression. And a book without a reader is an unfinished book. You know, when I wrote the last sentence of my book, it meant exactly what I meant it to mean. It had one set of intentions, and that matched up with what the book was. And then when you send it out into the world, it starts to take on all sorts of different meaning. And it's the most amazing thing to be a part of as a writer, not only because you get to see, or you get to sort of experience how people are similar and how they're different, how people respond to things that you thought were entirely unique to you, not only unique to you, but isolated you from other people. Then someone shares your book. I've experienced this as a reader. And you say, the things that I thought had isolated me most are the things that connect me most strongly. But also because the book just gets better as it goes out into the world, because it starts taking on the weight of everyone's experience and everybody's reading and everybody's ideas and hearts. And I can't tell you how many times people have come up to me and said things like, you know, I liked how you alluded to Finnegan's Wake in this scene. And I think, I hope it was in the first 5 pages of Finnegan's Wake, because that's as far as I ever got with it. But, like, the moral of the story is that it doesn't matter if I have read Finnegan's Wake at all, because the book contains that meaning. That meaning doesn't belong to me. It belongs somewhere else, you know. And a book is as good as the people who read it. And, you know, that having been said, I think the best books and the books that I most love to read are the ones that most open themselves up to that. They're so many perfect books being written right now, you know, books that are, you finish the last sentence and you say, I don't know how that could have been better. That was really perfect. And then you put it on the shelf and that's it. And it's dead to you. My favorite books are like open wounds or open sentences, you know, things that continue to frustrate you, or you continue to think about it, you continue to care about. And most importantly, that you continue to contribute to, you know, that you, like, are complicit in co-authoring.
I'm not sure they actually answered my question, but what he's saying is so interesting that it doesn't.
Did you ask a question?
There was a question back there. I don't even remember it. I'm fascinated. Doesn't matter. But I guess I'm bringing you back to certain specifics in the book, and the way it is all about interpretation, and you might be uncomfortable even talking about some of those. So here's another, like, theme that I noticed in the book that I thought was really interesting, and which also I noticed it from comparing to Everything is Illuminated. And that's the interest in writing and communicating and codes. There's a huge amount of coding in this book, from the telephone beeping code that occupies 3 pages, and I, like Finnegan's Wake, I got to like the first 5, and I know it said help, and back after that, forget it. Mm. Maybe you could tell me afterwards what those 3 pages were. Or maybe I assume they mean something specific that's important and that some people actually figured out, but not me. There's your youngest fan leaving.
Actually, I have a younger fan. My brother just had a daughter born on Valentine's Day, and she has a T-shirt with the cover of my book on it. So.
Never too young to go out pimping for a family member.
That's right.
There are so many letters in different forms to take very important places in the book. There's a wonderful and sad idea that Oscar has of a bracelet he makes for his mother out of Morse code version of the messages that his father leaves on the phone at home while he's about to die in the World Trade Center, which his mother has no knowledge of. This idea of sending messages to people in various forms seems really important. I assume it's all about the idea of communicating.
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of anything more important. All of my books are about two people trying to talk to each other. Everything I've ever written is about people trying to talk to each other. And the total impossibility of ever saying exactly what you want to say and being understood exactly as you want to be understood, and the worth of trying. You know, the books are not depressing. They're not about how we will never be able to communicate. They are about how we continually try to communicate and how those efforts are so important and so beautiful. And those efforts are what, you know, love is. It's not, love isn't anything successful. It's just like the continued attempt at something that's impossible. And so I know that I write out of a position of being frustrated with how I can't say what I want to say. I assume every writer must be like that. And every person, you know, have you ever walked away from a conversation 100% happy with what you said? Do you ever think, I wish I had said that at that moment, or I wish I hadn't said that at that moment, or someone said, I just remembered this great joke that would have been perfect in that, but I didn't remember it then. In a book, there's no excuse for ending a book and saying, I wish I had said that at that moment, because a book isn't subject to time in the same way that life is subject to time. It's the only thing that I ever do that I can go back and fix. You know, everything else is just trapped in that, like, one-way stream. And
so have you ever regretted that you didn't do something somewhere, like, looking back on these two books?
It's kind of confusing, because I look back at my books and I see plenty of things that I would change now. But that's good, because I've changed. And my idea of a book is something that that is a very accurate, like, saying what you mean to say in a given moment. And when the moment passes, you mean to say something different.
So you're covered, like, for all time, basically, of never having to really regret it.
Well,
because you're always changing. This is a philosopher in you, obviously.
No, it's like, you know, when my first book came out in paperback, the publisher said this would be a very good moment to make any changes you wanted to change or if there are any corrections. And I went back to the copy that I take around. You know, I can even show you in this book. This is what I take when I do readings. So this book I finished, what, half a year ago, something like that? And obviously, you can't see this on the radio, but there are, like, oops, entire pages, you know.
You've crossed
it
out.
Yeah. because I just don't feel that way anymore. But
What page is that? I'm seriously, what page
did
you decide?
Why would I tell you? There's actually a good long story about that whole crossing out, but we don't have time for it. my only point is, you know, as I wouldn't handle myself in conversations as I would have 6 months ago. I'm a different person. I would speak differently to my friends. I have different concerns. I have different means of saying things. The world has changed. You know, I think differently. It's the same thing with a book. But writing books, it's not like doing a high jump. You know, you're not constantly trying to clear a greater and greater height. I don't want my next book to be better than this book. I don't think in that language. I want it to be a close expression of who I am when I'm writing it, a close expression of my concerns, of my fears, of my hopes, all of those things, and it will necessarily be different.
This idea of changing occurred to me when I compared the photos from my, you know, early review copy of the book to the photographs that were included in the, you know, published copy, and a lot of them are very different, and I was sort of surprised at the changes. And it makes sense in the context of what you're saying. And I know the photographs in the book, if you read the book, you realize most of them really, they illustrate very important things that are going on. They're very clear what's happening. I think early on, people really misunderstood them. A lot of them refer specifically to Oscar's book of stuff that's happened to me. It's not even really that experimental if anybody's read, you know, W.G. Sebald. And this is not a new technique. And I think it was very interesting, but were your choices for changing those photographs in the final copy the same as now looking back and crossing out those paragraphs?
Well, I guess to the first part of what you said, no, there isn't anything particularly experimental about it, and I would never, ever do anything in the interest of being experimental.
Yet people have accused you of that, so it's interesting.
Well, it's very funny. You know, if I were a painter and I brought text into a painting, who would find that noteworthy? Only the most reactionary conservative critic. That's how I feel about people who are getting up at arms about images in a book. I think it's a reactionary response. It's incredibly conservative. It's incredibly protective of the novel's boundaries. And if a novel is worth anything, it's because there are no boundaries. It's because we're not protective of the boundaries. It's because it's the place where we say, let's experiment. You know, there's this very dangerous idea in the culture now that a bad book is as bad as a good book is good. Like a bad book is negative one and a good book is positive one. That's why major book reviews would put a bad review on the cover. And that's sad because bad books aren't that bad. You know, they take care of themselves. They're forgotten. Like, no children starve because somebody writes a bad novel. But the effect of a good book is very real, and it's very good. I mean, I've read books that have changed my life, and I know there are people who feel the same way, and there are books, I think we could agree, novels that have really changed the world. If it takes 100,000 bad books to make a good book, that's a small price to pay. Now, I think good books are the result not only of good writers, but of a lot of bad books. You know, writing is a lot like science. You know, we depend on the experiments of other people. And it's no coincidence that certain decades produce good books in bundles. I think it's because all of the bad, necessary bad books were produced in those decades, or maybe in the decade before, and we should be grateful for those bad books. So the idea that, you know, experimentation is something that there's a great risk in it, or that it's something that needs to be really pushed down, I don't understand it, I guess. Particularly if we believe that we want to encourage reading. You know, if we take that as a good end, then we have to take, we have to invite voices in. And right now, I think the culture is not open to voices. That having been said, why did I change so many of the images between the galley that you saw in the book?
And I can borrow my galley, anybody, afterwards and compare them if you want, because I think it's the only one here. But
I just changed a lot of things. I wanted to keep working on the book. I found things that felt more right. And so why not change them?
Well, on that note, I'm going to make this a little cliffhanger because he's going to read another part of this in a second, but we are going to take just a very, very short break, and we will be back with Writers on the Record in about 60 seconds. So don't go away. Thank you, Jonathan Safran Foer.
You're listening to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman on 98.7 WFMT, Chicago's classical fine arts station, focusing on noteworthy authors who have published recent works of fiction or nonfiction. Each month, the featured author of Writers on the Record will be the subject of a brief Q&A in Chicago Magazine, accompanied by announcements in the magazine and on 98.7 WFMT for the interviews, which take place Sundays at noon once a month at Looking Glass Theater. Our next broadcast of Writers on the Record will take place on Sunday, May 22nd, when Victoria's guest will be Sue Miller, author of Lost in the Forest. If you'd like to be in the audience for that discussion, admission is free. 312-832-6789 is the number to call to make a reservation.
Welcome back to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman here at the Looking Glass Theater. I'm with Jonathan Safran Foer. We are talking about his new book, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. And he's going to read another segment in a minute. But before we get to that, and I'm like so totally out of sequence in this, but again, thinking about the characters and some of the themes in the book, it occurs to me that, and I know you're writing about love and communication, among other things, but every character, to a certain extent, every main character in the book, whether it's Oscar, his mother, his grandmother, grandfather, they're all defined by loss and by distance from loved ones. And that to me, this distance that you create and the fact that each of these characters has to deal with, you know, the dead father, the dead lover, the dead child, the baby, the not being able to communicate with the person you love most. Again, it's all about communication. But the idea that you created this entire book that's basically about loss, yet, as you say, it's not a depressing book at all. It's kind of an intriguing thing to look back on.
You know, it's funny. Somebody asked me the other day, you seem to have written about death in both of your books. Why? And I said, nobody asks J.K. Rowling, like, another book about wizards?
Ooh.
And wizards are not That to me requires some explanation. You know, wizards are not something that each of us confronts on a daily basis. We don't.
No fair. That's a series.
My only point is, like, death and loss are things that everybody in this room shares. You know, they are the most important things, some of the most important things in our lives, as are other things that are central to this book, like love, like the desire to communicate, like, you know, being scared. And I can't imagine ever not writing about them.
We've been talking around another really important character in the book and the idea of letters, and that character is the grandfather. And I don't want to spoil it for people who haven't read it yet because there's kind of some twists in this, but a series of letters that he writes to his, at that point, unborn child and writes every day for the rest of his life, and this packet of letters becomes a very important thing in the book. Would you read from, I think it's the first one, actually, that the grandfather writes?
Now, it's funny. I've actually never read this aloud in my life.
Oh, good.
I mean, it has only existed in my head. And it's happened to me before that I've written words that I don't know how to pronounce. You know, like...
There's nothing tough in here.
I hope not. I haven't looked at it. I hope not.
Well, at least you didn't cross it out in your copy.
Well, all right. That's because I wasn't ever intending to read it out loud. I haven't always... one thing I should mention is that the punctuation is sort of interesting here. There aren't very many sentence breaks. It's a lot of commas, as if like the words are just relentlessly pushing against each other. I haven't always been silent. I used to talk and talk and talk and talk. I couldn't keep my mouth shut. The silence overtook me like a cancer. It was one of my first meals in America. I tried to tell the waiter, "The way you just handed me that knife, that reminds me of..." But I couldn't finish the sentence. Her name wouldn't come. I tried again, and it wouldn't come. She was locked inside me. How strange, I thought. How frustrating, how pathetic, how sad. I took a pen from my pocket and wrote Anna on my napkin. It happened again 2 days later, and then again the following day. She was the only thing I wanted to talk about. It kept happening. When I didn't have a pen, I'd write Anna in the air, backward and right to left, so that the person I was speaking with could see. And when I was on the phone, I dialed the numbers, 2662, so that the person could hear what I couldn't myself say. And was the next word I lost, probably because it was so close to her name. What a simple word to say. And what a profound word to lose. I had to say ampersand, which sounded ridiculous. But there it is. I'd like a coffee, ampersand, something sweet. Nobody would choose to be like that. Want was a word I lost early on, which is not to say I stopped wanting things. I wanted things more. I just stopped being able to express the want. So instead, I said desire. I desire two rolls, I would tell the baker. But that wasn't quite right. The meaning of my thoughts started to float away from me, like leaves that fall from a tree into a river. I was the tree. The world was the river. I lost come one afternoon with the dogs in the park. I lost fine as the barber turned me toward the mirror. I lost shame, the verb and the noun, in the same moment. It was a shame. I lost carry. I lost the things I carried, daybook, pencil, pocket change, wallet. I even lost loss. After a time, I had only a handful of words left. If someone did something nice for me, I would tell him the thing that comes before, you're welcome. If I was hungry, I'd point at my stomach and say, I am the opposite of full. I'd lost yes, but I still had no. So if someone asked me, are you Thomas, I would answer, not no. But then I lost no. I went to a tattoo parlor and had yes written onto the palm of my left hand and no onto my right palm. What can I say? It hasn't made life wonderful. It's made life possible. When I rub my hands against each other in the middle of winter, I'm warming myself with the friction of yes and no. When I clap my hands, I'm showing my appreciation through the uniting and parting of yes and no. I signify book by peeling open my clapped hands. Every book for me is the balance of yes and no, even this one, my last one, especially this one. Does it break my heart? Of course, every moment of every day into more pieces than my heart was made of. I never thought of myself as quiet, much less silent. I never thought about things at all. Everything changed. The distance that wedged itself between me and my happiness wasn't the world. It wasn't the bombs and burning buildings. It was me, my thinking, the cancer of never letting go. Is ignorance bliss? I don't know. But it's so painful to think. And tell me, what did thinking ever do for me? To what great place did thinking ever bring me? I think and think and think. I've thought myself out of happiness 1 million times, but never once into it.
Jonathan Safran Foer. The description of why that man loses his speech later in his life. And the description of the firebombing of Dresden, you know, is one of really, not no pun intended here, but searing moment of the book. And also, along with that, the description of a survivor of Hiroshima. And it's, and actually, what that woman says in that one passage describing Hiroshima and what she experienced, where she says, you know, I thought that, I'm paraphrasing, I thought that if other people could see what I saw, there would be no more war. That, to me, seemed so much more the core of that part of the book, the idea of violence inflicted on human beings by other human beings, than the fact that September 11th transpired and that Oscar loses his dad. It's interesting to me that this has become, in a lot of people's minds, a book, one of the first books about September 11th, and kind of how unfair in a way that is. It didn't seem like that to me. It seems like there's actually, it's a weird thing to say, but a bigger picture than that.
I'm very glad you think so, because that's how I think of the book. You know, I don't think about it as being about any one thing. In part, you know, the danger in the way that the story of September 11th has been told is that it's told as one thing. It's told as the biggest picture. It's told out of any historical context or even geographic context. And it's very dangerous. The line, which you thought you were paraphrasing, but I think you actually got just right, about the Hiroshima mother who lost a child, she said, if people saw what I saw, there wouldn't be war anymore. I think very intentionally, we haven't been looking at things very closely in America. And, you know, right around September 11th, there was a change in the way that images came in and images were processed by the media and by consumers of images. To begin with, the coverage of September 11th was really dramatically different in the United States than it was anywhere else in the world. It was much more graphic in Europe. So there are good things about that and bad things. The good things is that it wasn't glorifying violence. It was violence. I mean, it was the truth of the day. People fell from buildings. And closing our eyes to that is to close our eyes to what happened. And it will be impossible to move forward in any meaningful way from it. A good reason to sort of temper the images is we don't want kids walking in front of TV sets and being traumatized for the rest of their lives. And also there is probably some issue of, you know, the privacy of death in certain cases. But it's interesting how after September 11th, the country became obsessed with decency and indecency. You know, the Janet Jackson Super Bowl issue happened. And people, news outlets that we would normally consider very serious, took that news as real news. You know, it was like front page news in real magazines and real papers. And it was kind of laughable. It was kind of funny. It was kind of kitschy. But it was also very telling, because I think what was going on was that we were realizing almost collectively that there were going to be an increasing number of things we wouldn't want to look at, and that it was time to start thinking about how we can regulate what we look at. You know, the news, the networks were thinking about it. They didn't want to lose advertising. The government was thinking about it because it was conducting, you know, preparations for a war, or maybe even the war had started at that point. And it's a war that is only possible when people aren't looking at it. If we, you know, the images that we get from Iraq tend to be of smart bombs, you know, going down chimneys, finding just the right person, there's no blood on the floor. And of course, that's nothing like what it's like. There's a reason that so many soldiers, I think more than half of soldiers that go to war come back with some kind of trauma, psychological trauma, saying some form of the same idea, which is, I can't believe what I saw. And we've become so accustomed not to looking that I wanted this book as much as possible to be about looking, not always in a sort of explicit or graphic sense, but in the attentive sense.
Well, you know, I think that you were in a very unusual position with this book. I mean, you were kind of like in people's sights in a certain way. I mean, having what people are calling the sophomore effort, the sophomore curse. How could you possibly top, you know, the first book, and people, you know, adored it, and what were you going to do next? And so to a certain extent, I mean, you couldn't really there's a certain number of people, I think, that just were gunning for you no matter what. And there's so many different ways to interpret this book, you know, whether you look at it in terms of war or in terms of love or in terms of this character, a nine-year-old, which some people really objected to you using. It was going to be very hard for you to present anything that I think people were going to just find acceptable. But at the same time, and here's another kind of leap on my part, and, you know, I don't tend to read things as in as analytical a way as obviously a lot of the people reviewing your book. But just as this book was not to me about September 11th, but was about something bigger, to me, you're not actually even really a writer. I mean, I see you, and in case people aren't aware of it, Jonathan Safran Foer's libretto for an opera is debuting in Berlin in September. There is another book about to come out that's a collaboration with the photographer Hiroshi Sugimoto and sculptor Richard Serra. There are several art projects he's working on in New York. Whispering Parabolas is one that's going to take place, and also 10,000 Windows, which is a collaboration with schools. If you go to his website, Jonathan Safran Foer, you'll see that it's called the Project Museum, and there are a lot of art projects that are being, you know, that are actively being thought of or worked on. There's so many references I found in the book. At least in my mind, I was connecting a lot of the things that Oscar was doing to very specific artists, Andrew Goldsworthy, Sophie Cal, Tom Friedman, Vito Acconci. People in the art world would recognize that this idea of apprehending, stopping, or capturing time and events, whether it's in the photographs, in the book, or in these other things that you're doing, it's like your life and what you're doing is beyond the books, in the way that the book was beyond September 11th. And I know that, you know, you sort of came to writing in a weird way. It wasn't what you set out to do. It seems to me that you're doing something very different. The book is just part of this framework.
I think about, you know, do you like to travel?
Yeah.
So presumably you like to see foreign landscapes.
Is this an analogy? You just cut to the chase. Okay.
It is, but it's useful. and, you know, like taste foreign foods, so on and so forth. You don't think of yourself probably as somebody who just loves to fly on airplanes. You know, it's not, you don't get excited to pack your bags and get on the airplane. It's that the airplane is a vehicle to take you to something you really are excited about. And that's how I think about books. I don't love novels. I really don't. I do love what novels can do and what I think they can do better than anything else can do for me. That's how I feel now. So I have no reverence for the form of the novel. If there's any way to change it to make it a better vehicle, of course I would. And if there were some other vehicle to take that would get me to where I want to go quicker, of course I would take that.
Which is what you're taking in these other projects?
It's what I'm taking in those other projects because I'm doing things that I feel like I just can't do with a book. And in this book, you know, I think the inclusion of images is dangerous to people, or feels it's noteworthy to people who love the airplane, you know, rather than the destination. And I think there are a lot of writers like that. They fall in love with the airplane and they paint pinstripes on it and they give it sleek looking. They put their pilots in uniforms, you know. It's unnecessary. It's really unnecessary. Let's just try to get to where we want to get to. And again, I think it's the difference between like a perfectly crafted book and a book that might show its seams, might bite off more than it can chew, might be messy, but is clearly like trying to get at something rather than itself being not only the delivery system, but the message, you know, the package.
Taking from that the idea of like who the reader is, you're talking about the person who's writing the book and conceiving of the book. The reader has a certain responsibility then too, to understand, oh, I'm, you know, taking an airplane ride, but really the destination's important, or whatever analogy we want to use for it. You actually, when John Updike wrote a review in The New Yorker that was sort of mixed. I mean, a very sensitive but mixed review. And you said in response to that somewhere that you didn't really feel that he was not really the right reader for your book. Why isn't he the right reader, and who is the right reader in that case? The person who wants to experience not the ride, but the destination?
The right reader is the person who who knows he or she is the right reader, who reads the book and says, this was the book for me. And I thought he gave a very thoughtful review. I liked it, actually. I was quite honored, to tell you the truth, that he would even read the book, much less review it. But it was clear at the end of the review that he didn't finish the book and say, this was the book for me. It's like that thing I was saying earlier about how, you know, sometimes we think that the things we feel most strongly isolate us, like the ways that we get sad isolate us, the ways that we're happy isolate us, they're only true for us. Then you read a book and you realize, no, that's not true at all, that we can be connected to other people. Some books provide that connection, some don't. The interesting thing is that you can't predict, you know, what kind of reader will be provided with that connection. Like I was in Japan in, I think it was November or October, and I went to a garden in Kyoto in the Tofukuji Shrine, and I can't ever remember having felt as strong a connection to an artist as I did to the person who designed that garden. I felt like somehow this person just planted my imagination or planted my inner life, or if I knew how to plant things, this is what I would want to do. And this person lived thousands of years before I was born, didn't use the internet, didn't have Jewish parents, didn't use an indoor toilet. There are 100 million circumstantial differences between us. And then this one fundamental overlap that dwarfed everything else, which was like our humanity somehow. Somehow I was sharing something with this person, and it was such a relief. That was the overwhelming emotion I felt, was relief. And you just can't know. You know, John Updike and I have a lot in common in certain ways, and we have a lot that's not in common in certain ways. But one of the things I find most inspiring about books is how that humanity you can have in common with somebody quite far away. And it's one of the reasons, incidentally, it's such a shame that in America we read so few books in translation. About 3% of the books sold in the country are in translation. And a lot of those are just retranslations of classics, Proust, Tolstoy, and so on. In Germany, I think it's 40%. In Italy, it's 35%. In Spain, it's about 35%. And so we become talkers and not listeners. There is no conversation of that humanity. And the danger is not just that we're missing all of these incredible books. I mean, poor us that we don't get to read these things. But also, how are we supposed to relate to other people? You know, we're putting up walls that forbid relating. It's like the most extreme example is Arabic literature, which now there are all sorts of impediments for it to come into the country. Not only are we not encouraging it when we most should, but the Treasury Department, the Patriot Act have set up all sorts of impediments to bringing those books in. And if we spent less energy sending, you know, diplomats and troops out and more energy having books come in, I think we would You can't kill all of your enemies, but you can converse with a lot of them. And I think we're not making an effort to converse with many of them.
Well, we're going to make an effort now to actually converse with some of the people in the audience. That was a really ham-handed segue. But there are some microphones set up here. We do have, you know, we will take questions. Just get up your gumption, stand up there, and we'll ask you some. And what I was thinking of during part of that, just come down here and line up, and we'll take your question, is that, did you just look at your watch? I hope you didn't.
Did you just look at me looking at my watch?
It's going to be over in 10 minutes.
I wanted to make sure people
understand. I was just thinking, you know, he's married to this other amazing author, Nicole Krauss, whose book, A History of Love, is just coming out. And what must their dinner conversations be like? Oy, 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 oy. Anyway, well, yes, let's take a question. We may not be able to get to everybody, but we will try in the next 10 minutes. Would you like to start? Yeah.
Thank you. My question, I hope it's not too personal. You talked about books being perfect, changing your life, or books as an open wound. Would you mind sharing a few of books of yours that changed your life or the open wound thing?
That is not
for us.
That is not what I would consider a personal question. I got nervous when you said that. Kafka really changed my life. Gabriel Garcia Marquez changed my life. A lot of artists have changed my life. Joseph Cornell changed my life more than any other artist in any form. And Chicago, of course, is the best city to see his work. If I hadn't seen his work, I wouldn't be a writer. I'm just absolutely sure of it. It opened my eyes to what is possible in art. And I don't mean that in any sort of formalistic way. It made me feel like, oh my God, if I could ever make somebody feel something that resembles in any way what this artist has made me feel, that's worth devoting my life to.
Let me just add here, if you don't realize that Jonathan's first book was actually something that he edited, an anthology of works by writers who were inspired by specifically the bird boxes of Joseph Cornell. It's called A Convergence of Birds, and you can get it on the internet. It's out of print, but it's absolutely beautiful. Another question.
I read that you took a couple of creative writing classes in college, and I know that classes in college tend to focus on, you know, shorter fiction, and I was wondering if you could talk about your first confrontation with longer fiction, you know, with sitting down and being like, oh my gosh, how do I start writing a novel?
My first confrontation with longer fiction began with shorter fiction, and a story that it occurred to me might be able to just move in different directions. And it was the only thing I wrote that was long before I wrote Everything's Illuminated. It was a novel about Siamese twins. And I was a character in the book. And I had a kind of relationship with one of these Siamese twins, and then I had a relationship with the other one. And my only real memory of the book at all is a conversation I had with my father about a sex scene in that book. And he said to me, where do you get this stuff? And it probably goes to something interesting about writing, which is, you know, everything. I am not like my characters. I am probably some sort of combination of all of my characters that I've written or could possibly write put together. You know, there's a 9-year-old part of me. There's an 80-year-old part of me. There's a masculine part of me. There's a feminine part of me. There's an animal part of me. Anything that I could write about must be contained within me. But my characters are exactly like me. You know, nothing comes out unless it came from within me. So what I found funny about that conversation I had with my dad was he didn't think that I had had sex with some Siamese twins, but the mere fact that I had thought of it, you know, is in itself so shocking. It's like the old Philip Roth problem. You know, after Portnoy's complaint came out, you know, do I want to shake this guy's hand? Who knows where this hand has been? So maybe he didn't do all of the things in his book, but he was somebody who thought about those things.
Another question. Yes.
I knew when I saw the cover of this book that it would be extremely interesting and creative because I thought the cover was so amazing. But I just wanted to find out, I had heard that you did go truly to Europe to find the background of your family, and I wanted to know if that was true. Number two, is this an autobiography of yourself in finding the meaning of life? Because glancing through it, I read it a few months ago, and then I read it again last night because I knew I was meeting you. Is your true belief that love is not important and money is not important, that it's really peace? And unless you have this inner peace, not only with other countries, but within yourself, you have nothing. Is that your philosophy of life?
Well, you're referring to Everything is Illuminated, right?
Yeah, you're talking about his previous
book.
Right,
I'm talking about Everything is Illuminated. I'm sorry.
No, it's great. It was based on, a trip that I made to the Ukraine. I had a photograph of a woman who I'd been told saved my grandfather during the war.
Right.
As it turns out, the trip that I made was nothing like the trip in the book. I met no Alex, no grandfather, no dog, none of that stuff. It was very autobiographical. But, you know, there's a danger in – sometimes I think fiction is read on the terms of journalism or nonfiction. So we think – when we say is a novel autobiographical, what we mean is it biographically close to the author's life? I feel that my second book is much more autobiographical than my first book, even though it's biographically more distant from my life. I'm not a character in the book, and I don't share many experiences with characters in the book. But I feel like I got better at saying what I wanted to say in the second book. And so in that sense – I was me more. You know, I was at a high school the other day, and a student said, I keep a diary. I love keeping a diary, but I want to become a more serious writer. Can you maybe give me some advice on how to make that shift from diary to novel? And I said, why would you want to make that shift? You know, to my mind, a diary is the most pure and, like, noble form of writing there could possibly be. I've tried it many, many times in my life, and I still try it occasionally. And I just have the hardest time with it. I never sound authentic. I never sound like myself when I'm giving the biographical story of my life. What I've found is that in novels, I can throw my voice, sometimes quite far, into a 9-year-old, into an 85-year-old, and suddenly I do sound like me. I feel like myself in a way that I never could in this voice that you're now hearing.
Thank you. Let's see, we have time for another couple questions.
I thought it was interesting you chose to read one of the letters from the grandfather, because that's actually what I had a question about. I'm a psych grad student, and so I think in the same way that you think of everything as philosophy, I think of everything as psychology. And in Gestalt psychology, it tells us that we long for closure. And you comment how the punctuation is kind of off in this, so there really isn't any closure. It's like this force that's just driving you to keep on reading. I was just wondering, was that your intention, or did that just kind of happen?
It was absolutely my intention. I'm interested in closure in my life, but not in my writing. My first book ends in the middle of a sentence, and I wanted the implication to be this isn't something you close the book, but you don't close the book, that it's a kind of invitation, you know, not the party itself, that there should be a conversation or a participation, or that it leaves my hands and becomes something else once the book is finished. And I want everything I write to be like that as much as I can. The thing that I most value about books is how much they withhold, you know, how much they require of the person who receives it. Nobody can receive a book in the way that you can receive a movie or even receive a piece of visual art. They necessarily demand less than a book demands. Kurt Vonnegut once said something like, books are, in a book, the audience is the orchestra. You know, they perform the music always. The person who reads the book performs the book. I write a word like tree. It's four letters. It's the smallest thing in the world. It's 2 millimeters on a page, black ink on a white page. But then it conjures a mental image for you. A huge tree that's bigger than any tree in the world, even though it takes up no space in the real world. And it's completely personalized to you. Maybe it's the tree in the backyard where you grew up or the tree on the street that you pass every day now. But it's your tree. And that's what's great about books, is how they move out from what might seem definitive in a way, just because it's, you know, type that cannot be moved on a page, into something that is so fluid and so personalized for each person that reads it. And in that sense, there could never be closure. And thank goodness.
You know, I'm not actually sure that we have time for any more questions. We have one. Who's got a short question with a short answer? You? Okay, you win.
I think so.
Okay, I'm sorry. And you can ask him afterwards, okay?
I also have a question about Everything is Illuminated. I haven't had a chance yet to read your new book. And your character, Alex, that you mentioned is, I think, one of the most inventive characters I've read in a long time. And I was just curious how he evolved in your writing.
That is not a short question. Never mind. What's your question? Wait. He can answer that after. Do you have a short question?
How do you feel about the book being made into a movie, and does that compromise kids reading the book?
In fact, there are no short questions, as it turns out.
I'm sorry about that, but you can actually ask him afterwards.
Alex developed very organically, just like Oscar did, as I was saying in the very beginning, that he developed out of like my own need to laugh at things and my own need to be moved by things, and I just pursued whatever moved me toward humor or toward sadness. How do I feel about the movie? I feel like it, like I feel about osteoporosis. Like, you know... I have assumed that one day it will happen to me, and yet I haven't taken any great precautions. I haven't even dwelt on it too much, as there are so many more immediate catastrophes lying in wait. Now it's coming out in August, and I guess I'm quite excited.
And the film rights have been sold, actually, to the new book as well, so we're going to get lots of movies of this in the future. We're going to have to go. I do want you to mark your calendars for Sue Miller on May 22nd, Michael Cunningham on June 12th. We'll take a brief hiatus for 2 months and then start up again. You've been listening to Writers on the Record with Victoria Laubman. Thank you so much to Jonathan Safran Foer.
A contributor to WTTW 11 Chicago Tonight and Artbeat, and also seen on CBS2's Eye on Chicago, Victoria Lautman, the host of Writers on the Record, has written articles for the Chicago Tribune, USA Today, The Reader, and the Chicago Sun-Times. She has been the Chicago editor for Metropolitan Home, Art and Auction, and Architectural Record, and has also contributed pieces to Interview, HG, Elle Decor, Architectural Digest, and many other magazines. Next month's live broadcast of Writers on the Record will feature the author of Lost in the Forest, Sue Miller. That will take place on Sunday, May 22nd at noon from the Looking Glass Theater Company in the Water Tower Waterworks at 821 North Michigan. If you would like to be in the audience, you may reserve a free ticket by phoning 312-832-6789. Our special thanks to everyone at Looking Glass Theater, including Executive Director Jacqueline Russell, General Manager David Schmitz, and Director of Production Lee Potter Murray, and to Chicago Magazine, including Editor Richard Babcock. The audio engineer for Writers on the Record is Eric Arunis. The director is Louise Frank. Steve Robinson is the executive producer. This is 98.7 WFMT Chicago, a service of Network Chicago.